Hey everyone, it's James Cochran. I'm checking in at the beginning of this episode to give you a content warning. Ginger and I spend the first 8 or 9 minutes talking about the COVID-19 pandemic and our experience of it. And we realize that this is something that is just swirling all around all of us right now and is something that you might be coming here to spend half an hour away from. And if that's you, and you'd really rather skip our COVID-19 discussion, just skip ahead to the 9 minute and 30 second mark where we dive into this week's topic, which is the Netflix series Love is Blind. But if you do listen to our COVID-19 intro, I hope you'll forgive the jarring and poorly edited reintroduction that we do at the 9 minute and 30 second mark. In any case, we're really glad you're here, and we hope that you are well. See, now say a lot of more words.
I don't know what words to say. I'm drawing a blank on words, James.
No, that's fine. Well, how about So
let's just go with it.
This is Super Together. I'm James Cochran.
And I'm Ginger Rothis.
How's your quarantine going?
Weird. This whole thing is like alternate universe. I feel like out of body almost. Like, is this really happening? Are we really experiencing this? I don't know. I cannot get my head around it.
Yeah.
I keep thinking like I have this brain fog feeling of like what's really happening? How nervous do I really need to be? How careful do I really need to be? What news source can you trust? It's just so weird.
Yeah. I feel like a lifetime of anxiety has prepared me for this moment.
Yes.
Seeing the movie Contagion in
2011.
Oh, it's a dynamite film. Steven Soderbergh, one of my favorite directors, who I'm just now realizing I've never actually heard his name said by anybody else. So I don't know if it's Soderbergh or Soderbergh. Anyway, but he's just made a ton of good films. But Contagion, I think I basically recounts the reality of what we're experiencing now.
Isn't that it's just crazy that it was forecast. John Molnar, who is Katie Couric's husband, I follow him on social media, and about a week ago he was showing clips from that movie on his Instagram feed.
It's a good movie.
The one I saw was the credit card. The virus was on the credit card, and so then it passed to the person who received the credit card and handed it back, and then the subway handle, and then and it was just enough to make me think reality is stranger than fiction.
Sure. I was trying to find a clip from that movie the other day where near the end of the film they've developed a vaccine, but it's in short supply. You kind of get it in, you know, if your birthday's here, you get it in this, your birthday's here, you get it in that. One of this, you know, high-ranking public health official gets access to it and is aware of like a, you know, custodian whose kid is immunocompromised, and goes and says, "Hey, you can have my vaccine, and we'll get you your bracelet that says you've been vaccinated." And at the end of it, they shake hands, and he says, "You know, I don't know if it was the Old West or where it came from, but the idea was, shaking hands is a way of saying you don't have a weapon." And he said, "I wonder if the virus knows that." And so it's just,
that's powerful.
Right. And I was trying to find that clip, but I couldn't find it anywhere. But certainly recommending the film Contagion, if for no other reason than if you're trying to escape reality by diving deeper into reality, Contagion is a way to do that.
I don't know if I can handle it right now.
You know, so we're at home with our two kids, and they've now closed school for the rest of the year. I think that there's going to be a distance learning something or other. That's going to, I think, be less relevant to my preschoolers. I don't know how much investment there's going to be in that. So we're trying to figure out exactly how that, you know, factors into what we're going to be doing with our kids. Again, we've talked about this before when we talked about when we did the quarantine for couples episode. But we're super privileged. You know, we've got... We'll figure it out. My my wife was trying to help us draw our attention to people who, you know, we have friends who are just now starting to foster. Like Monday, they got their first foster kid.
Oh.
And how that, you know, okay, so now they've got a life to care for all of a sudden. So there's that dimension of it, but like, how do you navigate childcare when like, you know, daycares are closing left and right? And so it's just a, you know, and it's just a difficult reality for a lot of folks. One of the things that I have been encouraged by, and I mentioned this on our special episode with the meditations that we released, is I feel like I see a lot of people rising to the occasion.
I do too.
And that's just super encouraging. I think I told my wife yesterday, like, I feel like we're gonna be a better humanity as a result of this.
I do too.
There's a poem that I'll read maybe at some point during the podcast, but just about, you know, it has always been the case that we're this deeply connected. It has always been the case that we need to be paying attention to the people in our world who are vulnerable and are immunocompromised and are elderly and, you know, are isolated and alone. Mm-hmm. And now we have to, you know, now it's imperative that we do. So in any case, that's our life that we're living.
I feel kind of a breakthrough coming to and a rise of consciousness and, you know, a sense of humanity and helping one another and the generosity that I'm beginning to see of people taking care of each other. And, you know, I remember hearing a spiritual teacher describe before the space shuttle breaks through the sound barrier, it reverberates the most.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, you know, maybe we are breaking through to a new level of consciousness, but we have to have this virus reverberate us into paying attention again. And, you know, so I'm trying to find hope in that. And I think the anxiety producing thing is just, it's hour by hour with, and everything seems very in limbo. New announcements coming out, you know, new statistics. I think that as I've gone to phone calls with all of my clients, and you can just hear when we start the phone call, their voice is tight and nervous and full of questions. And then by the time our hour is over, we've both calmed down.
Yeah.
And but what it reminds me of is that our thoughts are so upsetting to us, and connecting with one another is a way of calming ourselves down and knowing what's true and what's right and where peace is.
Yeah.
I feel like all week my work with clients has been, let's just touch peace. Let's tap into peace.
Yeah. No, I've made that transition as well. And I think that it, I was on a meeting today, and it was a virtual meeting with almost the entire department that I'm working for on a contract basis. And it was person after person just saying, like, you know, this is really hard emotionally, relationally. People saying, like, I come into work for, like, the relationships that I get when I come into work, those are meaningful. Those are restorative to my soul. We don't often think about that. We think, like, oh, yeah, time off from work, because there's a lot about time off from work that would be valuable in that way. But at the same time, paying attention to the fact that, you know, you know, I've got a friend who's a younger guy. His family's all out of town, you know, and 2 weeks alone for him would be, you know, maddening.
Right.
Whereas, you know, I'm going to be, you know, busy, you know, without stop. So, yeah, I think it's good just to have a health reflection of this. And I think we mentioned escape. And, you know, as much as I want to name the realities that we're in the midst of, I also want to recognize that there's a lot of people naming the realities, you know, that we're in the midst of. I am doing a study right now with some friends from church about just sort of daily and weekly habits to sort of deepen your spirituality. And one of the ideas is curating the media that you consume, being really intentional about what you consume. And when we talked about that a little bit last time, but we want this media, if you're listening and consuming this, to hopefully be something that you identify as meaningful, valuable, restorative, not something that contributes to all the anxiety that you're experiencing.
Exactly.
This is Super Together. I'm James Cochran.
And I'm Ginger Rothis.
And we are talking about all kinds of stuff today. But the thing that is on everybody's mind, as we all know, is there's a bug going around. And that bug is called Love is Blind Fever. That was good, right?
That was good.
And It is a Netflix series. And so first couple of things. One, spoiler alert, because we'll, you know, if you are the type of person that when you watch something, you want to hold on to suspense for the entirety of it, we'll be dashing most of that suspense. So go and watch the show Love is Blind.
And then come back to this podcast.
I think we'll be talking about some of these things conceptually beyond just the show. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're not interested in ever watching it, certainly you can continue to listen. Maybe we can kind of go back and forth and do a recap. I'm thinking we might do this as like a two-parter,
okay,
like episodes 1 through 5, like, which is basically right up until they leave Cancun.
Okay.
I think. And then the other episodes, which is where they like start merging their lives together and then end up deciding whether they're going to be together forever or not. So if we were going to recap, episodes, or maybe even just describe first, like, what's the central conceit of the show? Like, what's the premise, so to speak?
Yeah, so the premise is this experiment of putting people, men on one side of a condo building and women on the other, with these pods in the middle, and they can kind of speed date, move from pod to pod, but you can't see one another. Mm-hmm. So it's just conversation. And so the premise is, can I fall in love with somebody without ever seeing them? And I was intrigued with the premise. I think it's a cool experiment. And, you know, what you see is we take away all of our senses besides hearing and a sense of stirring the soul, if you will, and just go to conversation and emotion and words and build connection in that way. So I was intrigued at first, but I have a question for you. Is this, okay, so what is these, like, the staged reality kind of thing? How scripted is this stuff?
So my sense is that, so here's how I imagine it happening.
Okay.
I imagine that there is, there are dimensions of reality to it,
mm-hmm.
Where it's like, okay, yeah, just kind of go bananas.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's sort of a stable of producers nearby,
okay,
who are saying, you know, we'd love to get more footage of you in conversation with this person.
Yes.
So why don't you jump in there?
Okay.
And so there's maybe some guidance along those mm-hmm. lines. Certainly, you know, one of the things, my wife got into the show before I did. And she was the first to suggest that we have a conversation about
yes.
this.
Yes. Yeah. I hadn't watched it either before Lindsay suggested it.
And, you know, and yeah, so I have very little patience for artificial drama.
Okay.
Where it feels like, you know, actually the first scene of the show that I actually like watched was near the end of the show where there's weddings happening,
mm-hmm.
and they drag out the suspense mm-hmm. of will they or won't they
mm-hmm.
for what feels like minutes and minutes and minutes and minutes, you know, just, and I'm just thinking like, okay, cut to the chase.
Right.
So I'll confess, what I have watched of the series, I have watched at double speed on Netflix's or on Google Chrome's, you know, video speed
yes.
controller thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're talking at double speed, you know, blah, 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 you know,
right.
and it's just because I recognize how highly produced it is,
yes.
and how easy it is for it to feel like that what I'm watching is not necessarily a reflection of reality,
right.
but of what those producers think will be most entertaining.
Right, exactly.
So that's in answer okay. to your question, how produced is it? I think it is. I think that these are real relationships that are being coached into appearing dramatic.
Yes.
And okay. edited into appearing dramatic. Because it's very possible that, you know, there is, you know, someone says something, someone says, you know, and then someone reacts to it, mm-hmm. but the reaction that we're seeing is to something else that they said
right.
instead of the act, you know. So I couldn't say how much of that is or isn't happening, but I'm assuming that it is
yes.
because I'm pretty sure that's how most of these shows run.
What I was really intrigued with is at first when they were first meeting each other, the importance of asking questions
mm-hmm.
really struck me, and how those of us that have been in partnerships for a long time sort of forget what that initial getting to know you phase is like.
Mm-hmm.
So in episode 1, I was intrigued with that and how you know, how you get to know someone was intriguing to me. And so the questions they would ask, and then how quickly people were sharing emotions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and with no, nothing but voice, how you could connect with somebody. That's sure. really intriguing.
Yeah. You know, what I find, the one of the broader themes of this part one that I think we can explore is what are the constituent elements of intimacy mm-hmm. or the requisite elements of intimacy? Mm-hmm. What's because, okay, so they take away the appearance, you know, the visual interaction. But another thing that they take away that they don't often name is context.
Right.
You know, you're not meeting somebody and, you know, at a dinner party with right. all of your friends. You're not meeting right. somebody in the context of your church or your work or yes. something like that. It is an exclusively one-on-one mm-hmm. interaction. Mm-hmm. And that, is, in my estimation, that is one of the requisite elements of intimacy mm-hmm. is that you're stripping away all of those other elements of context. I had a professor, yes. and really this is a relationship theorist, one of the early pioneers of family systems theory, named Murray Bowen. And he talks a lot, and this is now entered, I think, our collective consciousness, but this idea of triangulation. Mm-hmm. And we think about triangulation where it's like, you know, Ginger and I have a beef with each other, and I'm going to go talk to my wife about it mm-hmm. because it's easier to talk to my wife about it than it is to talk with Ginger about
right.
it. But my one of my professors, who is a Bowenian purist, essentially helped me understand that when we talk about the weather, we're triangulating. Because ultimately what we're doing is we're saying that a connection between you and I feels too intense. So instead, we'll talk about this third thing. We'll create a triangle between me, you, and the weather because that level of connection is difficult. And that helped me reconceptualize this idea of, okay, what are all of the ways that triangulation moves its way into our life really as a barrier to connection? And part of what I think this show does is it de-triangulates everybody. Now, it adds triangulation by putting everybody, you know, all the guys and, you know, they're right. all becomes buddies with each other and all the girls and you're meeting all these other
and
people.
And you're dating the same people.
Right,
yes.
right. But fundamentally, and that's, I guess, an element of the show's premise that right. we didn't necessarily name is that, you know, it really, at least so far as I can tell, focuses on these five relationships mm-hmm. or five girls, five guys. Mm-hmm. These are all heterosexual relationships. Mm-hmm. So these five guys are like sharing a clubhouse. Mm-hmm. The five gals are sharing a clubhouse. Mm-hmm. So they're all connecting with each other. And, oh, who are you talking to? Who are you talking to? These two girls are getting connected to the same guy, or these three girls are getting connected to the same guy. So there's all those elements that's sort of the normal, you know, bachelor and real world and all that kind of drama. When it comes to the, you know, they call them the pods. When it comes to the pods, it is a stripped down, you know, like we only have each other mm-hmm. to connect with, and we can't talk about the weather. We can't talk about most of what else is going on. We can really only talk about ourselves and our experience.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that's the question asking part was so intriguing of like, what do you love? What do you like to do? Who are you? What, you know, and it made me realize how we filter so many assumptions mm-hmm. Based on what we see and or context, as you said. And we are so quick to label and judge. And it fascinated me to watch without any of that. How people describe themselves,
yeah.
What they choose to share,
sure.
And then how somebody receives that description and filters it through their own, you know, reconciling of, is this a match for me or not?
Yeah.
And there were people, as you get to know them more as the episodes go on, you know, there were some people that shared everything very upfront, and there were other people that held things back. And, you know, and we each have that kind of human discernment process constantly of, I want a connection with this person. Will sharing this improve my connection mm-hmm. or deteriorate my connection?
Yeah.
And so without any facial clues or visual, you know, things to pick up on, it was very interesting to see how people felt safe or not safe in what they shared.
Yeah, there was one, you know, there were a couple of interactions that I'm recalling from some of the first episodes and the first interactions, you know, where people would kind of make assumptions about the person that they were talking to, mm-hmm. like, oh, well, I think you're an African-American woman mm-hmm. because of how you sound, because mm-hmm. of the way that you're talking. And how, I mean, again, is that something that you would you wouldn't say that because you wouldn't necessarily need to say that if there was a right. visual kind of interaction. But like, why did it feel important to name that? And what is the experience like of having that part of your identity named and, you know, coded in that way? We'll talk about, again, we've already alerted to spoilers, but in the early episodes, one of the central decisions about what to share and what not to share comes from Carlton and Diamond, mm-hmm. is one of these couples.
Mm-hmm.
They are, I can't remember what they do for a living. Diamond is a dancer, a professional basketball dancer.
Yes.
Dances for a professional right. basketball team. Yeah. Carlton, I can't remember what he does.
I think he was in media yeah. or, yes.
A lot of people were like media experts, right. content creators,
exactly.
you know, managers,
right.
things. They were very nondescript. And I think everybody was based in Atlanta was the impression that I got.
Okay,
too.
That's interesting. I missed
Atlanta,
that.
Georgia. Because I think it would be challenging if everybody, you know, if you're all over the country and you
right.
have to, you know, relocate in that way. But Carlton, I think that the identity he preferred to describe himself as was fluid. Other people would probably misname that as bisexual. It's probably the closest approximation that our listeners might be familiar to, which is that he had had intimate sexual experiences with both men and women. Said that was primarily based on this idea that he was attracted to people, not necessarily attracted to, you know, body parts and those types of things. He felt that he had experienced a lot of judgment because of that. And again, one of the other, what is the noun for contrive? Is there a noun for contrive? Contrived?
Okay. Yes. Yes.
One of the contrived yes. aspects of the show is that you don't get to meet the other person until you propose and they accept your proposal.
Right. And he did not share all of that before the proposal.
Correct.
Yes.
And all of that happens within a space of a handful of days.
Yeah,
four
like
or five,
three
6 days.
Yes.
Yeah, just
yes.
not
right.
nearly...
not enough time.
Yeah. Well, what feels... we'll say, in our professional opinion,
yes.
not enough time to develop a stable relationship. Now, again... it's possible that removing all the triangulation, maybe it is enough time.
Yes.
You know, maybe that's the equivalent on an intimacy perspective going
of
on
weeks
30
of dating.
Dates. Yeah, exactly. One has
right.
a hard time knowing. But he didn't share that. He felt like that was a part of his story that wasn't relevant. Now, mm-hmm. I think it's telling that he says that to the cameras and names that as a conscious decision of, like, I'm not telling her. Mm-hmm. I'm anxious of how she's going to respond when mm-hmm. I am telling her. As a, you know, as a therapist, I think that that's a big red flag.
Mm-hmm.
It probably reflects some insecurities in Carlton.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something about that part of his story that he feels mm-hmm. a measure of shame about or a level of defensiveness mm-hmm. about or a lack of clarity about.
Or he didn't feel safe sharing it yet.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
And,
mm-hmm.
And ultimately, I think it can be chalked up to one of those things when we are in relationship with somebody and we find ourselves connecting in every way, we, I think, are probably reluctant to engage with this maybe one piece of content that doesn't feel like it might fit, mm-hmm. or at a minimum that there's the highest risk about,
mm-hmm.
where it's like, when I reveal this, how are they going to respond?
Mm-hmm.
And especially, it sounds like he has... I would gather that he has had experiences in the past. Now, he said at a later date, like, no one's ever had a problem with this, so I didn't think it was a big deal. I think that his own naming of that is probably reflects that there's a complicated truth mm-hmm. there at a minimum. Now, from Diamond's perspective, and I also recognize I'm doing a lot of the talking. I have a lot of opinions about this. I know you do, too. From Diamond's perspective, I feel like she handled it pretty well.
Yes.
She, in that moment, was... supportive and affirming when it was revealed on their sort of mm-hmm. honeymoon, you know, this
right.
little vacation that they went on to after they had accepted proposals. And then the next morning felt like she had to say, hey, this is what it's like for me. One, because I don't feel like I have a full understanding of what it means for you to be fluid. And two, because this is something that you didn't share with me. How did you respond to that narrative, that plot line, that interaction?
Mm-hmm. Well, and then it degrades quickly into mm-hmm. a name-calling fight.
Yeah.
And I think that what you alluded to is what we saw play out, is that his insecurities went right into a defense mechanism.
Sure.
And he couldn't see that she was trying to understand. He jumped into a fear of judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And then that brought out the worst in both of them.
Yeah.
But what I think what was interesting in that and watching it, and this is where the producers, of course, want more exaggerated responses, because it's sorry, it's more fun to watch. James's eyebrows are going up with coronavirus.
No, what listeners can't see, although maybe we'll post a video of this, is that in my office, I have a 6-foot board.
Yes, and we are literally six feet apart.
We're 6 feet apart. We're paying attention.
So
to all
the
of these.
Frog in my throat is nothing more than a frog in my throat.
I will. Yeah.
But I think what, unfortunately, for people watching this as a reality TV show, that's not how that conversation
sure.
would normally go. And the heightened sensitivity around it, the heightened time frame, the pressures, the sensationalizing of it. I think that what both of them were doing were trying to approach each other with an open mind and disclose what they felt was a secret,
sure.
Which I think models in all of our relationships, you know, holding a secret can destroy you. Mm-hmm. And he knew it was, I can't not share this with you. And I do think she was trying to process a little bit and get her head around it. And we don't know how much time transpired between first hearing it and then that next yeah. to the pool fight. But I think what it gets at, and I saw this in other couples too, is this desire we all have to be seen and heard and understood, and that the whole premise of Love is Blind is if I don't see you with my eyes, I see you deeply, mm-hmm. You know, in a deeper soul connection. And I know the essence of who you are and the core of your being based on the conversations we've had. And I thought that's really all of our human longing, right, is to yeah. be seen, heard, understood, chosen, loved. And there's another couple, Jessica and Barnett, I think.
Well, Jessica
and Mark.
And Mark,
yeah,
right.
so Jessica's dating two of them, kind of mm-hmm. keeping them
in
both.
In the pods, yeah.
Yes, in the pods. And she gets this kind of moment of rejection from one of the guys who is choosing somebody else, and you see her kind of spiral into the pain of not being chosen.
Yeah.
And I thought that's such a human condition too, that so many of us know of what was wrong with me. And and she was hanging on words he was saying and really reading more meaning into things than he intended. But what all of those storylines, those initial kind of wanting to be chosen, wanting to be liked, really brought up in me all of our human condition to be picked.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And loved.
I think it was so much about this, you know, points to if you create an environment where the stakes are kind of artificially high, where it is it's me against this specific other person, mm-hmm. right? This other person that, in fact, I know and have had interactions with. Mm-hmm. I think that what it creates in us is a sense of, well, if I'm not chosen, that I'm not valuable,
right?
And so ultimately, if I don't think anybody's watching Love is Blind saying this is how I'm going to learn to be in a relationship. Or like, hey, I'm curious about whether or not Love is Blind. One of the other things that sort of a central complaint that I had from the show, there are some people of color, but it's exclusively, you know, heterosexual relationships. And my wife doesn't like this phrasing, but I said everybody's hot,
right.
to speak. Like there's a very, there's not a lot of body diversity.
Right.
There's not a lot of, there are not a lot of people who move through the world in a way where their appearance has probably not been a privilege for them.
Right.
And that's going to shape, you know, the dimension of rejection. There was really one instance, and I think it's between Jessica and Mark, where that attraction or barrier to attraction mm-hmm. Felt really salient mm-hmm. early in the relationship. But beyond that, everybody was like, oh, like, you know, this companion that I've chosen is somebody that I can find myself being attracted mm-hmm. to. And so that, I think, was a knock against the show. Mm-hmm. One of the things that when I look at the constituent elements of intimacy, I think I love this idea of being chosen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in many ways, these people, their connection is strengthened by the fact that they have to sort of commit to each other. Mm-hmm. But on the other side of that coin, one of the things that I experienced was some of the declarations that were being made were so extreme, were so conclusive and so final. You know, it's easy for me to watch. My wife described Jessica as a lost puppy.
Yes, I agree.
And there are a lot of elements that I think is very true. But you could also look at that and say, okay, that's somebody that's been in a relationship for a few weeks.
Yes,
because that's
exactly
the reality of what she's experiencing.
Right.
Because I think what's difficult for us to really appreciate within the context of the show is that, you know, you're if the dynamic of the show is such where it's like, okay, you got to propose, hey, okay, you've got a wedding date, you know, then the stakes feel really high.
Right.
And so you're using your words to describe a situation that might not necessarily reflect your lived reality or the lived reality of your partner. You're saying, hey, I love you more than anything in the world. I've never met anybody. You know, it's that extreme articulation of affection that I think is a product of the show. I would also say that that is something I try to coach couples away from, like when I'm teaching them how to interact with each other, not necessarily from a space of affection. I think that it's fine to offer affection in that way. But when we're trying to name our individual experience and we do it in those kinds of sort of dramatic ways, it doesn't leave any room for nuance. It doesn't leave any room for growth, for understanding, for if everything is perfect, so to speak, which is, I think, how they all wanted to experience these relationships, because that's the only way you could explain getting proposed, you know, getting married to somebody so quickly, is that everything is just how magical that these five people all fell in perfect love with each other by virtue of this experiment. So in any case, it feels to me like that element of the show, the sort of artificial stakes where it feels like everything is to the extreme, is something that I would encourage people to sort of name and pay attention to as they
on that same. I was writing down some quotes of within a few conversations we were hearing, I love you, I love everything about you, I know his soul, and so I just captured a few of those, thinking, when we say these things, what do we mean by these phrases, right? And we all, I mean, you could see their faces light up when they would hear that, I love you and I love you too. And I thought, what does it mean? We don't explore what that really means when we say those things.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, the thing for all of us to think about in maintaining our relationships is, what is it do I love about this person?
Yeah.
Why do I love this person?
Yeah.
What do I cherish about this person and treasure about this person? And I thought it did invite us, as superficial as the show was, it invited us to think a little bit deeply about who we choose to be with.
Yeah, yeah. And what is it about the, you know, I think maybe part two will focus more on the actual physical dimension of this. You know, one of the other elements that I felt was especially, I don't know if problematic is the, but you know, some of the patterns that I saw surfacing in sort, you know, the cracks starting to form, was the show. Okay, so, you know, the couples go through their pods, they find people that they want to spend the rest of their lives with, and these five couples are whisked away to Cancun. Now they're all staying in the same place. And so what, you know, they don't know that, and it's sort of just sprung on them. It's like, oh, like we're, you know, we can interact now with the people that we didn't choose or that didn't choose us.
Right.
And for one person in particular, for Jessica and this Jessica and Mark dynamic, that was incredibly disruptive, I think. I think that it created in her a lot of doubt, insecurity. She found herself more physically attracted, I think, to Barnett, which is the person that didn't choose her, than to her partner, Mark.
Right.
And that is a sort of a case study or a, you know, a microcosm of this idea of like relational comparison. You know, I think that it is easy for us to look at another person's relationship and say, well, why isn't our relationship like their relationship? And usually the answer to that question is because they're different people and we're different people. It is also probably the case that there may be a dimension of communication or assumption that goes into their relationship. So let's say, for example, that you're observing a couple kissing and you think to yourself, oh, well, why don't we kiss like that? Why don't we have this sort of, you know, public display of affection like that? Well, that's a really interesting question. Is that something you want in your relationship? How, why didn't that form in your relationship? Is it because you never named it? Is it because you, you know, is it because it's not something that you really want? Is it because, you know, one partner really doesn't want it and one partner does? But usually couples don't have those kinds of conversations. A couple right. will come to me and they'll say like, well, our relationship isn't like these other relationships that we see. Well, why not? Like, right. let's engage in an honest conversation about mm-hmm. that. That, to me, is the only real value in comparison. But fundamentally, I don't think that we are really ever better off by looking at somebody else's experience and saying, how can I judge my experience based on theirs? What's that quote yeah. about comparison and the comparison's the thief of joy
yes,
or something like that?
Yes, it is. Yeah. It is. Comparison is the thief of joy. And yeah, I think that comes from a lack of doing the work on ourselves of mm-hmm. what do I want. It's easier to look at something and say, oh, that must be what's ideal, instead of what do I want. I remember a friend when we were younger and we would go shopping together in high school. She would buy the man whatever was on the mannequin, right, head to toe. And I never wanted what somebody else had put together. You know, I sure. liked the creativity of. And so as we went into our adult years, it was so interesting of I was always thinking, what do I like? What do I want? What do I? And she never did. She thought, if that looks good, then I'll do that. And it's really interesting, as adults, we'll talk about it sometimes, of like, I've always been this introspective person. Mm-hmm. And now I'm in this field of work, which makes a lot of sense. But I think we can do that in our relationships too, of, is this working for me? Is this what I want? Is yeah. this, and, but that takes some facing of who am I? And a lot of people don't know the answer to that question either. Mm. So I think this show also kind of highlighted who was really self-assured as they went yeah. through this process and who was, you know, searching for something, but they weren't even sure what they wanted.
Yeah, yeah. No, that is that sense of people really being forced to confront what they want out of their relationships, mm-hmm. what they want out of their lives in general, mm-hmm. Is a valuable place for us to end part one.
Okay.
Because I think in part two, we can explore, okay, so, you know, the cracks start to form in, you know, episode 4, episode 5, when they're in Cancun, they're confronting these other couples, and then their lives merge. You know, mm-hmm. they go and they all stay in the same apartment complex mm-hmm. for a minute, and then they, you know, got to figure out, okay, well, how do we, let's meet families, let's blend our lives together, let's plan a wedding and all these types of things. And we'll spend the second part. Yeah, stay tuned. So next week, we'll release part two, and we will spend some time talking about that. In the meantime, you can find information about my practice at talkingwithjames.com.
And mine at compassionfix.com.
And we'll continue to try to find ways to be engaged with you all as we enter this quarantine phase. I'm not sure. This might be our last time in the studio for a minute. I might have Ginger take the microphone home with her, and we'll
Clorox. Yeah. Every day is a new experience.
Yeah.
Right
so,
now.
In any case, we'll continue to try to find ways to record, but that is, we'll at least have part two coming in a week because mm-hmm. we're going to press stop, and through the magic of editing, mm-hmm. we'll record the second part.
Be well, everyone.